All right, everybody, thanks for joining us. A quick heads up and then we'll get started. We are going to record 1 or 2 hours today, depending on the call volume. Calls are starting to come in right now. Questions are still a little light, so this may be your chance. If you've got a question, a comment, a topic, anything you want to talk about, press 1 on your phone right now and we'll get to you. The longer you wait, the tougher it is to get through. So let's go ahead and get started.
Your money, your taxes, your truck, and your road to success in the trucking industry.
This is Trucking Business and Beyond, the show that puts the money where it belongs,
back in your pocket.
Welcome to my world. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. The show is all about the business of trucking. We take your calls and answer your questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, taxes, technology, health and fitness on the road, getting started as an owner-operator, finding freight, working with brokers. The list goes on and on. If you've got a question about anything at all, pick up the phone, give me a call. We'll talk about it here on the air. I think what I'm going to do tonight is just get right to the phone calls. We've got lots of them starting to pile up here, and I want to get to as many as I can. So let's start off in Atlanta tonight. Mike, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin.
Hey, what's on your mind?
Oh, not much. I'm wondering if CARB has done any studies on these DPF trucks regenning going down the road. Seems like once a shift, I'm smelling it from about 5 miles behind, and you can come up on them, and they're blowing out that white smoke, and it don't look very healthy to me.
Yeah, you know, the whole thing is just, there's so much more to this. I'm all for clean air. I really am. You know, I've spent time in other countries where mechanical diesels are still the norm, and I forgot how bad they really pollute. I don't want to go back to that, but I also think we've gone way too far in the direction of trying to clean it up, and we may or may not be making things any better, especially if we look at the picture for the whole environment. What does it take to produce all of these DPFs? How many resources are used that are polluting the planet just to produce them, then to clean them? What about producing DPF? That's a chemically intense process. And then we have to package it and ship it, and that has an impact on the environment. Then we know that when these trucks don't run right, they burn more fuel. That has an impact on the environment in a lot of ways. Then when they don't run right, are they polluting more? It certainly looks like it. So it's one thing to say we want a cleaner environment, but are we really creating a cleaner environment by doing this? You know, I read a really in-depth article one time comparing the environmental impact of a Hummer from start to finish, producing it, driving it, repairing it, disposing of it at the end of its life, and they compared it to the environmental impact of a Prius, and it turns out that the impact on the Prius was actually worse. Producing the batteries, the whole process, it was crazy in depth, and yet, you know, we think of the Hummer as killing the planet and the Prius as saving it. And that's just not the case. And I think the emission trucks could be the same thing. It looks good, but is there any real research to show the whole life cycle of one of these vehicles, all the consumables, all the problems that it could create? Is it really any better for the environment? We know it's certainly not better for the industry economically. Economically, these trucks are killing the industry. And what if it turns out that they're no better for the environment? Maybe they're worse.
Exactly. Well, with you're talking about the electric car, they have to do the mining, which is terrible for the environment, to get the rare metals for the batteries. And it's same way with the DPF filters, the rare metals in them. And so hopefully with CARB having to admit the problems I heard over the weekend show, you were talking about how they admitted they're killing these engines. Hopefully someone can move forward with maybe putting a stop to it and come up with a more common sense approach. My good buddy, who's an owner-operator with the company I'm leased to, bought himself a 2011 International ProStar with about 350,000 miles on it. Not just singling out the ProStar, but it's been a good truck for him. But he spent $8,500 last year replacing that whole DPF system on his truck. So any of you guys out there that are thinking about one of these DPF trucks, please wake up and realize that they're nothing but wallet killers. And he was not happy about that. And he's talking about gliders now, so I can't blame him at all for that.
Right. I agree.
And, basically, we've had a lot of talk about gliders on the show the past few weeks, and you know, I've called and asked more than my share of questions about them. And I've been talking to the guys. I wanted to see the guys at Kenworth in Memphis and Indianapolis, and salesmen at both dealerships were familiar with the Fitzgerald gliders, and MHC in particular is working with Fitzgerald, and they can order you pretty much any Kenworth you want that the glider kit is produced for, a W9 or a T660, and they'll customize it any way you want it, color, interior. The reason I'm looking at ordering one is because I pull dry van, the 53-footers for FedEx Express, and I really want the roof cap on the studio sleeper, and it seems like you don't see them coming from the factory with them anymore. And basically, I've been talking to the guys about, I definitely want to do disc brakes. They're going to put disc brakes on it all around. It's only $1,200 to upgrade to that. I figure if that keeps me from being shut down at scale one time over the lifetime of the truck for not having my brakes adjusted right, that's worth it. Because if your pads are the right thickness, I'm told, you know, there's no slack adjusters on the disc brakes that they can measure and give you a hard time about. But the question I have for you is the gearing, because you know, I was wanting to go with 279 rear gears in the 13-speed and basically drive 55 and 11th and then have 12th and 13th when I want to go a little faster. I've got 342 gears right now in the Volvo, and when I have to push it and go a little quick, the RPMs are a little high for me in 13th. We have to do about 70 or so. And basically, they're pushing back, saying the highest gear ratio I can go is like a 306, I believe. Do you know anything about that? And what gear are you recommending these days for like a T660, Kevin?
What engine?
That's going to be the 12.7 Detroit.
Yeah, then I would go with the 279s if they'll do it. And that's the problem we keep running into. Sometimes it's just an engineering thing. Sometimes it's a matter of that gear is no longer available to fit the housings that they're using. So we do run into different problems with this. Your other option, if they just won't do it, is if they won't do it from the factory as a rolling glider. The other option is to buy it as a true glider with no differentials and then build your own rear end setup. I mean, this is where we were heading. If I could build my ultimate truck, we'd start with a glider, screw the factory because they're hard to deal with on rear end setups. I would put a fully locking differential on the rear with whatever gear choice I wanted then at that point, because we can go build anything we want if we're not trying to deal with the factory. And in this case,
right,
I would build it with a fully locking 279 and a forward lift axle. And, you know, it's possible that we can build that pretty close to the same price as we'd get a true tandem, you know, out of the factory. So that's one way to go. The easy way is to work with the factory, see if they can come up with a solution. You need to be somewhere in the 270 to 290 range. Whatever possibilities they have there. If they're saying 308, which is probably what they're talking, although there could be a 306 now. They come up with new gears all the time. I've had 308s before. You could make the 308s, well, no, I'm not going to go that far. You can make 293s work with the 12.7 at 55 miles an hour. It's actually a really good choice. I think 308s are going to end up giving you too much RPM at 55. So I don't know that I'd be willing to try that combination or not. 293 is about the highest gear ratio I would go. Or the lowest,
okay, so,
highest number, lowest gear ratio I would use. 279 would be ideal. And again, if they've got some new number out there, anywhere from 270 to 295, somewhere in there, is what I would want.
Okay, that sounds good. I'll talk to about that. They were going to call engineering about that. And, you know, the other nice thing about ordering is you can choose your wheelbase options. They have MHC has a couple of Studio Sleeper T660s in Tennessee, but they're 260-inch wheelbase trucks, and that'd be a little long for my operation. Once a week, I'll pull a grocery load back Atlanta, and it, you know, sometimes you get in a little bit of a tight situation, and they're building them with a 260, and I'm going to go ahead and probably get like a 244. So,
all right, got to get to a break. We'll be right back with more calls right after this. Stick around, Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. We're going to get right back to the phone calls. I'm off to Ohio this time. Herschel, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin, and no, I am not asleep.
All right, good. We've got you awake today.
Yes. The other day I asked you if you were able to read over my sensitivity testing. You said that you did. But my telephone decided it didn't want me to hear what you thought about it, and I wondered what opinions or suggestions you might have from reading that, and then I have one more easy one after that.
Got it. So I went through it. I'm trying to remember. I don't think you really showed up sensitive to much of anything, did you?
All dairy, turmeric,
okay.
Soybean, yeah, all kinds of stuff.
Okay, so a lot of that stuff, like soy, you want to cut out anyway. Being sensitive to dairy is very common. The thing about dairy is there's still a lot of nutrition there. So I don't necessarily want to turn away from dairy completely unless you identify it's really causing a lot of problems. Now, the other food sensitivities, whatever they were, like I said, I read through it. I'm not remembering what they all were. The best thing to do is most of the foods you are probably sensitive to aren't that nutrient dense. There are replacements for the nutrients. I would avoid all of them. Just eliminate them out of your diet. That's the best thing to do with food sensitivities. And like I say, the dairy, that one I would kind of biohack a little bit and see what you can make work. One of the things that I've just been reading recently. It's amazing to me. The more I read, I'm still learning. There's still new information coming out. I just read a book by a doctor who really believes that many of our problems start with leaky gut. Now, I've read all about leaky gut. I know what it is, but I was under the impression that it's a more extreme thing. that if you have leaky gut, you're probably going to have some really bad symptoms. But it turns out that leaky gut is like a lot of things. There's a whole spectrum. There are some people that, yes, have leaky gut so bad it's almost killing them. But he says that we all have it to some extent. And that if we work to heal our gut, that a lot of other things will work better, which goes right along with the whole NTP program of addressing digestion and the gut. So it's all really starting to come together. And food sensitivities are triggered by leaky gut because it's those proteins and the stuff that's in those foods make it through our intestinal wall into our bloodstream, and that's when our body reacts to them. So, and they can also cause leaky gut. So they can cause it, and when you have it, then your food sensitivity is going to get even worse. So I would go through that list and just eliminate those foods. Find something else to eat. Again, the exception I keep coming back to, dairy and eggs, and people are sensitive to dairy and eggs, but they're so nutritious that I don't want to just give up on them. I'd like to find ways to see, can we tolerate them? Can we eat them and get rid of that food sensitivity? And if you heal the gut, many times you can. The other thing is it's the form of dairy. And one of the things I just found out, one of the best forms of dairy with the highest nutrient value is goat's milk kefir. Now, it's also one of the least likely to cause sensitivities. So, you know, it's something you might want to play around with. Go ahead.
That was the one dairy that I showed no reaction to was goat's milk.
Well, there you go. That's exactly the proteins are very different. Goats typically have not been hybridized the way we've done with cows. You know, our cows today are nothing like they were 100 years ago. They're not even like they were 50 years ago. Cows are raised in horrible conditions most of the time. But even if you're getting raw organic, the breed of cow can make a big difference in how sensitive we are to the proteins, whereas goats don't seem to have that problem. So if you take a good, high-quality goat's milk and then you make kefir, which makes it very probiotic-rich, it's kind of a superfood, and people tend to be less sensitive to it. So if I were you, I would think about just eliminate traditional dairy, but start looking for some goat's milk products that you like.
Okay. My other one is because of the turmeric. I've heard you talk about making homemade mayonnaise. I went and got some walnut oil, avocado oil, olive oil, but I can't use the regular in-the-bottle mayonnaise, if you will, or mayonnaise mustard, because virtually every one of them on the planet has turmeric in it. Is the dry stuff okay to use?
Yes, mustard powder, you mean, and then make your own?
Yeah, like just a regular spice mustard to use in your mayonnaise.
Yeah, you could do that. That wouldn't be a problem. I mean, you can also make mayonnaise without it. I mean, there's a lot of times I don't put any mustard in my mayonnaise.
Okay, and how important, go ahead.
Have you looked at Dijon? Does Dijon have turmeric in it? I don't think it does.
Well, the only one that I found so far is Grey Poupon. It does not say turmeric, but all it says is spices. So that leaves you open for does spices mean.
Here's why I don't think that it does. Because the color of the mustard comes from the turmeric. And if you look at Grey Poupon, it's very, very pale compared to the bright yellow, you know, mustards we're used to.
Right. Okay. And my last one, I'll leave you alone, is soybean and grain is a big one for me. How big of a deal is it that I have grass-fed at all cost, I'm still trying to find it, over the factory-farmed animals?
You know, here's the thing. I'm coming more and more to believe this, that the first thing we want to do to get our weight under control and most of our symptoms under control is getting our macronutrients right, you know, leaning much more towards the ketogenic end of things. Then I think the next most important thing we can do is improving the quality of the food we eat, and especially of the fats that we eat, because we're eating a lot of them. So I know it's a struggle to get grass-fed. I still struggle with it on the road. I struggle when I go out to eat, because you're not going to get it there. We're starting
right.
to see it creep in a couple places. So I'm not strict on that, but I really work hard. Like, my freezer right now is loaded with grass-fed meat, and I have the advantage of having a freezer. So, you know, I can order from places. So it's one of those things that with grain, there's no middle ground for me. I don't like to use the word never, but I can't imagine myself ever eating grains again in my life. I don't need to. There's no reason to. I found lots of ways around it, and I'm not missing it at all anymore. So that one I will not compromise on. When it comes to the quality of, like, pastured animals and pastured eggs, I work really hard, but it's not 100%. If I go out to eat, then I'm going to eat what's there. If I, you know, can't get grass-fed right at the moment, I'm going to eat conventional. I'm going to try to eat less of it, though. And that's just, I think that's a balance you have to try to find.
Okay. Thank you, Kevin.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. Let's head off to New York. Keith, welcome to the program.
Hello, Kevin.
I've
got a question for you. I've got a DOT physical coming up within the next 2 weeks, and the question crossed my mind. If the driver fails a DOT physical, he's medically unqualified to do his job, is he then eligible for disability?
That's, you know, I don't get stumped very often, but once in a while I do, and I'm always interested because then it means it's something I need to go figure out. I have no idea. Seems logical.
Seems logical, but we're dealing with government. Logic doesn't make
sense. I know. So hold that thought. The music's playing. I'm going to get to a break. We'll come back and we'll talk about that. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rothenberg. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. I'm talking to Keith in New York about an interesting topic. So, Keith, I'm assuming that you are asking specifically about Social Security disability, correct?
Yes.
Now,
no,
here's the here's what I do know about Social Security disability is that there's nothing clear about it. In fact, there are entire groups of attorneys who do nothing but represent people for Social Security disability. So it's never a yes or no question. It's you apply, you fight your case, you may or may not get it. I don't know that you'll get a clear answer from anybody on this. It may just go on a case-by-case basis, but there is some logic behind that. The other thing I know, though, and this is a good thing, this really is the way it should be, that may disqualify you from driving a truck, but it doesn't disqualify you from working and earning a living some other way. So the system is supposed to be designed as, you know, you can't drive a truck, we're going to, you know, pay you while we figure out some other way for you to get back to work and earn a living, and who knows what that might be. Now, it also brings up another idea. What if you have a private disability policy? And those are all over the board. They cover all kinds of different things, or they don't cover it. It would be interesting to know, is there a private disability policy that would cover this? I have no idea.
So that'd be a question to talk with your insurance provider about then.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Or an agent. If you've got an insurance agent that shopped the market and would know that may be a possibility.
Okay. Well, I've got really no concerns. I've got no cause to think I'd fail a DLT physical, but thinking about it coming up in the next 2 weeks, sometime in my life, that question may be relevant, and maybe I ought to plan for it now.
Yeah. Well, you know, we don't talk a lot about this on the air, but people – you know, when it comes to insurance, it's a touchy subject. I don't like to be overinsured, but there's also some risk to being underinsured. We talk about life insurance if it's needed, and not everybody needs life insurance. What we don't talk a lot, you don't hear many people talk about, is a disability policy. And if I remember right, the odds are kind of crazy. You're like 8 times more likely to be disabled and not work than you are to die. And yet we really don't think much about disability insurance.
Well, sounds like something to talk with my insurance carrier and see if we can be ready before that event happens in case it does happen.
Yeah, there you go. The problem with good disability policies are they're expensive, and they're expensive for a reason, because if they ever have to pay out, then they may have to pay out a lot, and I guess the odds are pretty high that they could have to pay out. One other thing to keep in mind on disability insurance, you have two options when you're paying for it. If you want it to be tax deductible, it can be. But if you make your disability premiums when you're paying for it, if you make the premiums tax deductible and you ever collect benefits, the benefits will be taxable. If you choose to make your premiums non-tax deductible, then if you ever collect benefits, that would not be taxable. So I would probably opt towards not deducting my premiums, because if you ever collect, the odds are you're going to collect a lot more than you paid in, then I would rather have that tax-free.
Better tax. I was listening to the show. I don't know if you remember when I called in a couple of weeks ago. I'm having trouble with valve cover gaskets letting loose.
Yeah.
And a caller of yours mentioned something about an air compressor might lead to this same kind of thing. Kind of wondering if I need to be looking for any other sorts of symptoms and what it can cause and what to look out for.
Good question. I'm not batting 1,000 today. This is another one. I'm not sure. I do know it can cause it, but I don't know what else we would be looking for other than maybe just inspecting the compressor. Are you doing oil samples?
I honestly tried to get one last time, and the guy conveniently forgot to collect it.
Yeah, so I would be looking there, because when we see compressors failing, air compressors, there are very specific metals we can see when it's happening. So that might be that would cost us a lot of money. You know, if we see a spike in a wear metal that correlates with the air compressor, that'd be one more piece of evidence that maybe that's where your problem is.
All right. I called Detroit about the problem, and they said get it in 20 minutes ago for an in-frame. But there's no other signs of bad wear, you know, aside from the valve cover gasket letting loose.
How many have you been through?
I've been through two of them in the past 3-4 weeks now.
Have you talked to Pittsburgh Power by chance?
I didn't want to bother them with this because, I know they're busy trying to make money, you know, make a living. I didn't want to bother them with the valve cover gasket question.
Well, let's get you on tomorrow during the power hour.
Yes, sir.
That's the whole point.
Okay.
You know, they, and you're right, they are busy and they spend a lot of time on the phone and, you know, they're helpful, but it's kind of why we created the Power Hour, so that we know we have, you know, two or three of their guys every week that'll answer questions like this. So let's do that. Let's get them on. If anybody could answer, you know, why you might be losing head. I don't believe Detroit right now that we need to get this thing in yesterday for an in-frame. So let's get you on tomorrow and let's talk about that.
Yes, sir. I'll call back tomorrow. Thank you again, sir.
All right. Excellent. Thanks for the call. I'm interested to figure that one out, too. Let's go to Nevada. Bill, welcome to the program.
Welcome. Thank you, Tim. Or not Tim, Kevin. I don't know
why. Yeah, what's on your mind today?
Well, it's a delicate subject, as your screen probably suggests. And there's no other way to put it, but question about bowel movements. And this is only because my family's got a history of cancer involving that system.
Right.
I'll be quite honest. When I go to the bathroom, there's no predicting what it's going to be like until maybe 5 minutes before.
Right. And
9 times out of 10, I'm using a lot of toilet paper to keep my tush clean.
Yeah, so let's just go through this in general, because it is a huge problem for most of the population today. And it comes back to one thing, just like all of our other medical conditions do. It's our diet. We should be going once a day, every day. And if we do, everything will be fine. If we don't, there are lots of problems it causes. You keep toxins in your body. It can cause cancer. It's uncomfortable. We could go on and on and on. But what it comes back to is the same thing we talk about all the time, getting your diet right and then healing the entire digestive system. And that comes back to good, clean food, not a lot of sugar, not a lot of carbs, good quality fats. And then, you know, I like to get the diet right first, because you can do that completely on your own. You don't need a doctor. In fact, they're the last person you want to talk to. You don't need a naturopath. You don't even need an NTP. There's tons of information about paleo diets and ketogenic diets, or in extreme cases, what are called elimination diets, like the GAPS diet, G-A-P-S, the Whole30 diet. There's lots of those. That I would start with and see how many. The other thing I would highly recommend today is start with a good quality probiotic. So that's a great place to get started is fix the diet, add a really good quality probiotic and probiotic foods. So kombucha, fermented vegetables, kefir, real high-quality yogurt, which is hard to find, those kind of things will go a long way towards fixing this problem. In fact, for most people, that's all it's going to take. Stick around. We'll get to more of your calls and questions right after this. Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. We're going to get right back to the phone calls. We're off to Arizona. Frank, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. Two things. Quick comment on health and then a question about my equipment. The health thing, if you haven't seen it, you'd get a huge kick out of it. But the federal government is now saying that don't drink skim milk. You got a 46% increased chance of getting diabetes. You got to love that.
Yeah, and it's really obvious why, and now we've been saying this, you know, for quite some time. The whole high-fat movement is finally starting to catch on. Fat foods have fat in them for reasons, and we keep stripping the fat out. Really bad idea. But when you strip fat out of milk especially, all that's left is milk sugar. So people don't think of milk as being sweet, but the more fat you pull out of the milk, the more you create a very high glycemic food. Low-fat dairy is it might as well be poison. That stuff is just bad for you. First of all, it's you know, when we look at the way we raise the cows with the antibiotics, the hormones, the grain fed, all of that stuff, the quality is bad. Then we pasteurize it, which kills anything good that might be in there. Then we homogenize it, which damages whatever fats might be left. And then we strip it of its fat, and it's junk food. But yet we've been told our whole life it's healthy. It's not. It's junk food. Now, if you go eat properly raised, high-quality, high-fat dairy, that is good food. So milk isn't milk. You've got to know what you're drinking.
Absolutely. But, you know, when the feds come out and, you know, they didn't say they were wrong. They said, we're the ones that found this out, you know. So, hey,
right.
On my equipment, I've got two, my steer hubs are leaking hub oil. And I've had it to two different techs. They open it up, they pull the plug out, and they dip out some oil. They say, well, it's just a little overfilled. Nobody filled it to begin with. And both times, it's within days, it starts leaking again and throwing oil. So I'm wondering, it is somehow not right, or it's lost
well,
its
interesting. Ability. It's interesting that you bring this up, because I'm dealing with the exact same thing on my coach, both my front hubs. They don't leak, but when you're driving, they'll spray just enough that you look at the rim and you go, what the hell's going on? Why do I have oil all over it again? And so I'm with you. The only thing I can see that might fix it is replacing the rubber seal. And certainly rubber deteriorates over time. The coach is almost 10 years old, so that's what I'm going to do. In fact, I had it on my list to get those and put them in. Now, I'm not going to know anything till I leave here, which isn't going to be till the end of May. But I'm with you. I can't find anything obviously wrong, so the rubber plug makes the most sense.
I'll tell you what, since you're not driving right away, you know, for the price of those, I don't know what they are, but it can't be more than about $15 a piece, those plugs. I'm going to replace mine today or tomorrow, clean it up, and then I'll call you back and let you know if that was the deal.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I'm almost wondering if a thin coat of grease on the seal might help it as well.
Oh, yeah. I could try that first easy. Like
yeah.
Grease, I mean, like fifth wheel lube type?
Yeah, like a good heavy grease, yeah.
Yeah.
I wouldn't go with the lithium. I would go with a good heavy petroleum-based grease and see if that might help.
All right, I'll try that first, and then, you know, I'll know right away because as soon as I get a truck washed and everything and clean it all up, it's back within a day
yep.
or two.
I know. Dealing with the same thing. So you can be the guinea pig and let me know how it's going. Let's go to Illinois. Michael, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. Nice to finally talk to you.
What's on your mind?
I'm not a truck driver, but I'm a diesel technician. I work on transit buses, trucks, cars, and stuff. And I've listened to your show now for quite some time, and you're always talking about truck maintenance and driver training and everything. But I haven't really heard anything said about, you know, training for technicians and independent shops. I know the factory is like Cummins, CAD, whoever, they provide training to their technicians, but I was kind of curious what was being done for training for independent repair shops to help them get up to speed, because I always hear on this show that people are getting behind on training, and apparently there's a lack of training, nothing available. And I was just curious, you know, what you knew about that. Is there anything available for independent technicians like myself?
You know, it is available. You can go to the factory courses. You have to pay for them. You have to take the time off. And I think that's where the problem comes in. And I think you're right bringing this up. I think there's a huge problem in this area, and I don't see it getting better. And the reason comes down to money. Training is expensive, and it's time-consuming. And we are, I believe, that our technology is outpacing our ability to train people on our technology. Our trucks are getting so complicated, and we're not training people well. And I don't know what the answer is. I don't see technology slowing down, but I don't see training getting better, mostly because of the cost, partly because, you know, we're in a transition where there are some guys who are very good at mechanical kind of things, but they are just lost when it comes to electronics, and they may not even have the ability to learn it. You know, the interesting thing I see Pittsburgh Power doing, Pittsburgh Power's been, you know, they were primarily a mechanical shop for decades, but in the electronic transition, I think Bruce is really got the right idea. He's not taking his mechanical guys who are used to turning wrenches and fixing mechanical issues and trying to turn them into electricians or electronic technicians. He's going to the electrical engineering schools, taking young, promising electrical engineers and bringing them into the trucking world. That's a much easier transition than the other way around.
Oh, yeah. No, that makes perfect sense. Since you bring up electrical and diagnostics at my job, that's one of the main things that I do. I do a lot of electrical drivability troubleshooting. I use meters, oscilloscopes. I use all that. And I see a lapse in that area.
You understand how complicated that is.
Yeah, yes, I do. And that's the reason why I'm calling you and bringing this up is because more training needs to be made available. I go to training as much as I can, when I can. A lot of the time I go to a lot of automotive trade shows where they have training on some of the bigger stuff. Like recently, I went to Kansas City. I went to Vision, and that's for automotive mainly. but they do put training on for the Ford Powerstroke classes, the Duramax, and for Cummins that are in the the medium duty, light duty Dodge trucks. So they do training for that. But other than that, I really don't see anything being done, for the big units. And another reason why I thought I would bring this up is recently I heard on, I think it was the Dave Nemo show, they were talking about bringing this mass, gigantic training event over to the States. It's Messe Frankfurt. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. They're supposed to be putting on a huge training event for the heavy-duty commercial market. And I believe they might be, this is what I'm thinking, I believe they might be putting that with Auto Mechanica Chicago. That was put on about 2 years ago, and I went to that, and that training event was a free training event put on by vendors, sponsors that paid for all the training. All you had to do was, find a way to get there, pay for your room, and pay for your food. And
right.
That made it very, very affordable for people to go. And in my opinion, if the industry wants people to get caught up and if they want to get everybody up to speed, I think they should do something exactly like Auto Mechanica Chicago.
Yeah, I don't disagree. I see another problem, though, and this is oh boy, there's the music. We're going to have to pick this up at another time because I won't have time to get that thought out. Call me again because I like this topic. I do think we need to talk about it. I think it's more widespread than just technicians. I think it's an industry problem. I think it's a society problem. And I think it comes back to the individual. We'll talk about that another time. I've got to get out of here. Thanks for joining me. See you next time. Be safe. Be profitable. Be fit and healthy. Always do the hard work and master the journey. Kevin Rutherford. All right, we're going to do another hour. Here we go.
Your money, your taxes, your truck, and your road to success in the trucking industry.
This is Trucking Business and Beyond, the show that puts the money where it belongs.
Back in your pocket.
Welcome to my world. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. The show is all about the business of trucking. We take your calls and answer your questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, taxes, technology, health and fitness on the road, getting started. The list goes on and on. If you've got a question about anything at all, pick up the phone. We'll talk about it here on the air. And these weeknight shows are so short, I'm not going to do an open tonight. We're going to get right into the phone calls and get to as many as we can. Let's go to Texas to get started tonight. Russ, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. How are you doing today?
Excellent. What can I help you with?
Hey, I got a 12-7 pre-emission Detroit. It's a glider. I had to have it in-framed, and I went to Detroit, like you suggested. I went to a Detroit shop. That's all they do is work on motors. They in-framed it. They told me the problem was that the injector tubes failed, and it let fuel and antifreeze into the oil, and it tore up the cylinders and the bearings. And since they've rebuilt it, in 5,000 miles, I used 2 gallons of oil. So I went back to the shop, and I said, hey, what's the deal? I didn't use oil before. And they
right.
told me I need to run this motor. It's got the newest newest liners and rings. And I have to keep this motor above 190 degrees. And first of all, it only runs 180 all the time. I mean, I rarely have the fan come on. And
right.
my second question is, they in-framed the motor and they knew this. Why didn't they put 190 thermostats in it?
Because they're wrong and they're trying to cover their ass. This is their version of a Hail Mary pass. Now, this happens. New engines do it. In-frames do it. It doesn't happen all the time, but it happens enough that I've talked about it several hundred times. For some reason, sometimes rings just don't seat. Now, at 5,000 miles, I wouldn't give up on this yet, because sometimes we do see them seat, even if they didn't do it right away. But usually by about 25,000 miles, if they haven't, they're not going to. Now, their talk of keeping the engine hotter, there's a belief, and I don't think we have any proof, that if you run this thing hot enough, we might get enough expansion, and it might force the rings to seat. Some people will say drive it like you stole it, and you might get the rings to seat. At this point, there's no harm in that. I mean, it's not going to hurt anything. You could throw some hotter thermostats in it. You could drive it really hard. I don't know that there's any proof that it works, but again, there's no real downside to trying it, because it's either going to work and they might seat, and if it doesn't, then we're going to have to do an in-frame again. I mean, the only other way to fix this is to go in and put in new rings and liners, and that's what they don't want to do.
Yeah. Well, I have a question then. How about if I put some cardboard or something in front of half of the radiator so that it runs hotter for a little while and see if that helps?
Yeah, anything that will get the temperature up. If you can get it up and, you know, the fan doesn't come on for a while and you can get it up over 190 or 200, those kind of temperatures aren't going to hurt anything. And it, like I say, it's a Hail Mary pass. I kind of doubt that that's going to do it, but it can't hurt to try.
Okay, yeah, this truck has been a handful. I had to in-frame it at 260,000 miles.
Now, let me just jump in here, because what they say about why it had to be in-frame made sense. My guess is you weren't doing oil samples.
I was not, no. But I didn't have a loss of coolant.
Doesn't matter. It doesn't take a lot of coolant, and it does, and fuel will never know. I mean, you can have fuel dilution, and we'll never know that. And fuel dilution is very destructive to an engine. If you have fuel dilution and coolant intrusion, we've got a disaster. My guess is that's what happened. So here's why that is such a double whammy. You have additives in the oil, zinc primarily, that are there to protect the metal from wear. Coolant strips the zinc out of the oil. So now your wear protection is gone. Then we get fuel in there, which dilutes the oil. There's a good chance that on an engine with coolant intrusion and fuel dilution, that soot was probably high. Now it's like taking all the protection away from your metal and rubbing them with sandpaper all day long. And that's how we wipe out an engine in 200,000 miles, and that could have been avoided with a $30 oil sample.
Yeah, well, I'll definitely be doing those now.
Yeah, yeah. And that's a good lesson for everybody. I hope that something now, let me tell you, I have seen a lot of engines burn a lot of oil in the first 5,000 miles, and then it resolves itself and it goes away. So I wouldn't worry too much about this one yet. If it gets to 25,000 and it's still doing it, forget it. It's going to need to be in-framed again.
Okay, well, that's what I thought. I just wanted to get your opinion on it.
All right, so let me know how it goes. I'd be interested to see. Let's go to Ohio this time. Dan, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, Kevin. How are you doing today?
Doing good. What can I help you with?
Hey, this is the driver that called you on the last episode of your nutrition when you were doing the level 3 of the NTP, the guy that with no gallbladder.
Yeah,
and
I remember.
I'm calling to give you an update, more as a warning for some others. I had some kind of scary happen to me, and I debated on with myself on whether or not to even call you on this, because I don't want you taking it like I'm blaming you.
No.
But I ran right out. I ran right out, and I got the hydrochloric acid, and I got beet kvass. Matter of fact, I believe I had Kim send you a picture of the label of the beet kvass that I'm drinking, because it has some other ingredients as well, and I wanted to make sure it was still good to drink.
Right.
Yep. And I also got some kimchi, and discovered I really like the kimchi. Not so much the beet kvass. Ugh, stuff's terrible, but I was forcing it down my throat anyway.
Okay.
But if you recall, I told you I've got gout real bad as well. And Friday night, my gout started to flare up, and I just dealt with it through the night. And Saturday, I got up, and I headed over to Pennsylvania. I got about halfway out there and stopped and got a bite to eat and took the hydrochloric acid when I did. Well, now, when the gout started to flare up, I started in with naproxen sodium, like candy, popping them like candy, trying to get the swelling to go down on my foot. It's still... My foot's still like a balloon right now. I can hardly walk. Well, when I had my lunch, I started feeling nauseous. Well, I didn't get much sleep the night before because of the pain in my foot, so I just played it off as, you know, okay, it's just because I haven't had any sleep. Finished my day, had my supper, took more of the hydrochloric acid, and had my supper, and that night I woke up projectile vomiting about
That's
six times
good.
Throughout the night. Yeah, well, and I mean... when I say projectile vomiting, I have never had vomiting like this in my entire life. I couldn't get out of the truck, walk to the back of the truck to do it in the lawn. It was out the side of the door, right on my side steps. So I got between about like the third and fourth time of this going around, I decided to get online and start looking. And I found an article that said hydrochloric acid and PSAIDs don't mix. Now, the article says that they cause bleeding and ulcers. Didn't say anything about nausea, but my experience was throwing up a lot.
Right. Yeah.
So I wanted I'm calling you because I wanted one to see if you'd heard anything like that, and whether or not the article I found was accurate or not, and two, to ask you about the beet kvass that I got.
The beet kvass was good. We can start there. Added ingredients are just fine. All we really care about on the beet kvass is that it's fermented and it has real probiotics in it. Other than that, additional stuff won't hurt anything, and sometimes it's good. Like garlic is excellent for us. I saw that one had some garlic in it. So, yeah, the beet kvass was good. What you experienced is one of the challenges I'm going to have doing this show. And if you hear me a lot of times, I will throw in the sentence, we can do some of this stuff on our own, but we run these risks of, I mean, the body's a pretty complicated thing. It's, well, there's the music, and I don't want to rush this, so I'm going to put you on hold. I'm going to come back to this. This is a really good example. And I'm going to correlate it with something else we do all the time here that I have the same challenge with. So stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. We're going to get right back to the calls. I was talking with Dan in Ohio. So, Dan, I'm going to correlate this to something I've been doing on the air for a lot of years, which is answering questions about taxes. And you'll hear me many times say, this is the rule, but I don't know what else is going on in your tax return, and I don't have time on the show to ask you everything. If you've ever seen a tax organizer, a questionnaire, there's pages and pages and pages and pages, and when we do a tax return, we have to look through all of that stuff, because if you have this, it affects it, or that. The health is the same way. If I were going to do a full-blown NTP workup, I have pages and pages and pages of paperwork that I need to be able to look at. I need to be able to look at symptoms. I need to be able to look at medications. I need to be able to look at a three-day food journal. Because of all the possibilities of other stuff that's going on. And unfortunately, on the air, we don't have that ability, but I don't want to stop helping people on the air. That's the whole point. So a lot of times you'll hear me say, here's what is going on. Here's what could fix it. But I'd really love you to go work with an NTP, because they will do all of that. They'll go through that paperwork. Now, the real danger here is that the stuff we're talking about doing is all natural. It has very few potential side effects, and they're usually not serious. But what you had was a reaction with over-the-counter medication.
And right, right. And I didn't want to come across like I was blaming you. I should have done more research and discovered that the two don't mix before I just started popping a leave. Mainly I wanted to call because, our conversation the other day about hydrochloric acid wasn't the first time I'd heard you mention hydrochloric acid. And my thought was, somebody better say something before somebody else has the same experience I did.
Yeah, and I'm glad you called. And I don't take it, as blame or anything. And I realize when I get on the air and recommend things to people, there is some responsibility there. And I take it pretty seriously. So I want this kind of feedback. The goal of all of this is to get off of all traditional medications, because they do cause problems like this. Now, that's not to say that the natural remedies we talk about, the foods, the supplements, won't cause a reaction. They will. And there's actually three reactions that are pretty common, and we're going to talk about those this week. But the reactions you would get are much more mild. They're not life-threatening. They're not health-threatening. They can be uncomfortable. But what you saw was beyond that. So I'm glad you called. You're right. That's a really good warning to put out. NSAIDs and hydrochloric acid, not a good combination.
Now, as soon as I realized what the problem was, obviously I laid off of both the hydrochloric acid and the NSAID for about 24 hours. I didn't eat nothing. As a matter of fact, I didn't drink much anything either. I got myself pretty severely dehydrated. I didn't realize I wasn't drinking much. I got that resolved pretty easily. But I laid off of both of the hydrochloric acid and the NSAIDs for about 24 hours, and then I started back in with the Aleve. And figured I'll get back to doing my diet once I get the swelling in my foot. I can't even put my boot on right now, so I can't get the swelling down. I don't know if you can imagine, but driving a semi with a foot that I can't hardly push the brake or the clutch, this particular time, both my feet are giving me problems. So I got to get the swelling down before I can go back to trying to deal with the digestion. Does that sound reasonable to you? Does that sound like I'm going the right way there?
It does. And the other thing, again, I would encourage you to work with an NTP. Gout can be, if we're predisposed to it for other reasons, it can be aggravated by a high fat, even a moderate protein diet. But there are ways to fix that. And again, this is where, we're limited on time on the air. This is why I'm promoting the NTP so strongly, because they will address, or a naturopath, doctor of Chinese medicine, a functional doctor. they can address those things and make it work with this good quality, high fat diet. But if you've got other issues, it usually requires working with somebody who can address them.
I'd love to get involved in something like that, but the cost of it's going to be the killer for me. I don't have insurance. And I don't know if that insurance covers it anyway.
Yeah, it doesn't. That's the unfortunate thing, that all the you know, a naturopathic can. So you might want to, look into the possibility of working with a naturopath on this. It's unfortunate that our health insurance will pay traditional medicine, which doesn't make us healthy, and it won't pay for the non-traditional stuff, which is trying to make us healthy. I don't know why we call it health insurance. We might as well just call it drug insurance. Let's go to Maryland. Mike, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. How are you?
Good. What can I help you with today?
Okay. So I have an S-Corp, and the income from there passes through to my 1040, personal 1040. Okay?
Okay.
That S-Corp owns the truck that I have, which is, in order to have it titled in the state that I live, you have to get a U.S. DOT number, okay?
Okay.
So I don't have an MC now.
Right.
Obviously, the address for the S-Corp and the address of my license and everything is just the same. It's a home business, right? So anyway, if I went and opened up a business office, say in a neighboring state, and applied to get and opened up a business there, like an LLC, and then I applied for an MC under that business name, which is domiciled in a different state, and then I leased my truck to that business, how does the taxes work when you have a business in a different state and then you're staying in a different state? That's what I wanted to know.
Yeah,
how
would
I do my taxes at the end of
what, I can start to go there. What are we trying to accomplish by doing this, though?
The main thing is if I get multiple trucks, and I don't want to lose my MC because one of the trucks is off for insurance.
Because
like I can drop and remove tracks as I want to, without losing the MC, because if you have only one truck, but if I had multiple trucks and I had both of them leased onto that company and I removed one of the trucks, I could still maintain my MC. That's what I wanted to do. And also I wanted to get it in an insurance cover the state because I'm on the East Coast.
This starts to get really complicated. Tax-wise, it doesn't have much to do with anything. And if that's what you're asking about the tax, I'll tell you what it does do is because you form the corporation in one state, that will be your home state for the corporation, but you're also operating that business out of a different state. So then you will have to register with that state as a foreign corporation, and it doubles your fees, sometimes worse, because most states tax foreign corporations heavier than they do domestic corporations. And you're adding a lot of complication. And this is one of those questions that almost goes back to the last one about health, that there are way too many variables here for me to start going through. Between a couple states, I'm not going to know the answer anyway. So if you decide you want to go forward with this, and I'm just not sure it's worth all the hassle and headache, but it might be, I don't know, because again, there's too many variables. I would sit down with a good small business attorney and spend $500 to $1,000 to pay him for his time to work through all this stuff.
I see. Okay. I hadn't realized it was it might be working against me.
It could possibly be. And again, there's just so many variables. And even if I could work through all the variables, which I can't, I may not know the answer anyway. There's a lot of legalities in this. So it's going to take a good local business attorney to walk through this, see if there's any advantage, or see if there's just an easier way to do this. Let's go to a break. That's what we're going to go to. When we get back, we'll get to more of your calls and questions. So stay tuned. We've got more stuff right around the corner. Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. We're going to get right back to the phone calls. We're off to Pennsylvania. Mike, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. Hey, I was wondering, right to the point, I was wondering if you have any intentions of bringing a nutritionist to the CMC and, you know, maybe do a little class and then individual evaluations.
We do actually have plans, and most of those plans are already happening. One of our listeners, he's still a driver, but he's also a certified nutritionist, John Reed, will be at the CMC. He will be teaching a session. He will be doing some one-on-one. John's got great qualifications because he's on the road. He deals with the same stuff you guys have to deal with every day as far as finding the right food, preparing, storing, all that stuff. He is a nutritionist, but a lot of nutritionists, the traditional nutritionists, I wouldn't bring anywhere near this event because they've been trained the wrong way. They've been trained on the whole low fat, all that stuff. John gets it. He is trained, so he understands nutrition, but he believes in the high-fat, low-carb, moderate-protein lifestyle. So I think John's perfect to have
awesome.
At the event. And I'm also I'm trying to bring an NTP as well. And I'm not having a lot of luck right now because there aren't any that I can find that are – closer than about 3 hours away. So I'm talking to a couple that are between 3 and 4 hours away. We may be able to get them in for a couple days, but we are planning on expanding the health offerings.
Well, if they do one-on-ones, wouldn't that make it worth their while?
That's what we're hoping. You know, that now the one thing we, you know, I want to make clear to everybody. You know, the CMC, for what it is, a five-day, very intensive business conference with multiple speakers. We start early. We go late. $1,500, you will not find a business conference anywhere that cheap. They are typically $750 to $1,000 a day is what most conferences like this cost. So the other day I noticed a conversation on Facebook where we were talking about the one-on-one sessions, or we have the advanced negotiation session going on in the evening. There's a charge for that. It's $250. And people
sure.
are saying, wait a minute, I thought everything was included. Well, everything is included. I mean, we have stuff going on from 6 o'clock in the morning at night. That's all paid for. What we want to do, though, is since we've taken you off the road for a week, We want to give you every opportunity to learn, to gain more out of this. But there's a cost to that. And I just want to let people know, you don't have to pay anything extra. You come to the event, you pay your $1,500, you get everything you could possibly imagine, but we're going to offer more, and some of that more might cost money. I mean, it takes people's time and you know, resources and all kinds of things. So, yeah, I'd love to have an NTP that came in, maybe did, you know, a session or two, maybe did some limited consultation, but they would also want to be able to say, hey, look, I'll do a 1 hour or whatever it is, and here's my charge. And
I just want people
to be aware that, yeah.
I did the negotiations class last year, and it was worth every penny. And, you know, for people that haven't been to the CMC before, my first year there, I've been in the business a long time, I walked out, my head was spinning. There was so much information. I didn't know where to begin. And
wait till this year.
My business, so I flew by the seat of my pants, and I was successful, but not to the extent that I am now. And, you know, when I walked out of there the first year, it's like, good grief, I didn't know where to start. You know, which end of the train wreck are you going to start with your business? And
right.
It took me a while to change my procedures in order to implement what I had learned, and it made all the difference in the world.
Yeah, so we want to expand on that. Like, you know, you went to the advanced negotiation, which was $250, right? That's what it is this year. I'm pretty sure that's what
correct.
It was. And you realize that one thing you pick up in there, one thing, because it is a much smaller group, it's more intense, you actually practice some of this stuff. All it takes is one negotiation after that class to pay that $250 back in a heartbeat.
It's a no-brainer, Kevin. It pays for itself 100 times over in the course of a year.
Yeah, and we love that. Our goal is to make sure every time you spend money here, it pays for itself 10 times over. So we hit 100, we feel like that's a home run. And we do want to do that with the health thing. So we do have John Reed coming. We have Jimmy Moore coming. Jimmy Moore wrote Keto Clarity. We're excited about that. And I am working on an NTP. And, you know, I wish I could do more as an NTP. I'm just looking at my schedule going, hey, I don't think I can squeeze another 10 minutes in anywhere that week.
Well, I mean, the way that you and the staff run around, you're busy as a one-legged guy in a butt-kicking contest. So, I don't see how you could possibly squeeze any more in. But, I mean, we are constant, as attendees, we're constantly on the run attending things. So, I mean, it's a huge demand on staff.
It is. And this year, you know, and this is totally up to the people who come. You know this. Some people show up for the main stuff, and then that's it. That's all they do, and that's wonderful, and you'll get tons out of that. Our goal is, look, we know this is a huge commitment for you coming to this. It's a cost. It's time off the road. It's time that you could take off the road and spend with your family. We know it's a big commitment, and we want to make everything available we possibly can. So if somebody shows up and they have the energy, we want to make sure there's something there to learn. So, you know, we're just adding that on the nutrition side as well.
Well, I'll see you in May. It'll be my fourth time. I don't anticipate not going in the future. It's just part of my annual budget. Looking forward to it. It's not only a great education, it's a great time.
Yeah, there you go. And thank you for that kind of support. 4 years, and that's becoming very common. When we first designed this program, it was a seminar. You came to it, you learned your stuff. It was great, always has been. Now it's an event. And more people look at it the way you do, and I love that. I want this to become so much more, and it is. And people are starting to see that there's value in coming year after year, and we are committed to make sure we keep delivering that value. So thank you for the support. Let's go to Texas. Chris, welcome to the program.
Hello, how are you doing?
Good. What's on your mind today?
I was wanting to know a little bit more about the new Cummins motor coming out in either 2018 or 2020 that's supposed to be non-DEF and non-DPF.
Yeah, I don't know a whole lot about it. I've read this, but you know, they also claimed that back in about 2008 that there was a company working on a technology that would have allowed us to use diesel fuel as the catalyst instead of diesel exhaust fluid. And the technology kind of fell apart and they couldn't really bring it to market. So it might happen. I don't know a lot about it. I don't think many people do yet. But even if it does, I'm just not that excited. If it does, it's going to be such new technology. We've been down this road so many times that this kind of new complicated technology takes us years or decades to work out the bugs. So whenever they launch it, I wouldn't go near it for probably 3 to 5 years.
Well, the reason I was asking about it was because I'm holding off buying a glider because I'm afraid that once I buy it, that and once Montana, Colorado, and Nebraska, if they ever get on board like California, that they're going to take and basically make it to where we have to.
Yeah. Let me get to the break and I'm going to come back and I'm going to address that because I have a very, very different opinion about that. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. We're going to get right back to some phone calls. I'm going to go back to Chris in Texas. So, Chris, let me give you my opinion on this. First of all, let's talk about the other states. If you look at the history of CARB in California, it took them over a decade, well over a decade, to implement their rules. And now that they have implemented them, it's a disaster. They're being sued by everybody. They did come out in court and say, yeah, we do know that the DPF is screwing up engines. We know it. We have to admit that. They had to come out and admit that their science about diesel exhaust was a fraud, that the scientist who did all the testing wasn't a scientist. He had lied about all his credentials. It's a disaster. There are no states on the books right now that even have anything in the works. So I don't see any state anytime soon implementing the same stuff that CARB has done. Most of them are sitting back and saying, look, we don't need to go through all that hassle. The EPA is already doing it for us. The EPA isn't going to make anything retroactive. That would wipe out the industry. So the EPA has said, look, we'll just keep putting tougher and tougher standards on new trucks. The old trucks will eventually go away, and the states are just going to follow that. They're not going to go do what California does. And if they do, screw them. Just don't go to that state anymore. seriously, but the odds of that happening in the next decade are so slim that I just wouldn't worry about it. On top of that, I'd much rather take my chances that the state may do this and I can figure out a way around it than take my chances on more new technology, especially from the engine manufacturer who's had more problems with their technology than anybody. I mean, Cummins clearly has the biggest problem with their engine right now, so I certainly don't trust them to come out with technology I'd want to own.
I'm just afraid of buying a glider based on, the government saying, hey, you have to put a DPF in this thing.
Yeah, I don't see that
happen. Based on the year of the glider.
But you're fearing, so that's almost fear, like say, you know, I'm really worried that a meteor is going to hit the Earth. I mean, there's no indication anywhere that the government is going to mandate DPFs on anything, because it's not just gliders. If they mandate it on gliders, they have to mandate it on every pre-emission truck, and that would devastate the industry. It's just not going to happen. There's nothing in the legislation that says it's going to happen.
I didn't quite look at it like that, but yeah, you got a point. All right, well,
so
I appreciate your time.
You're welcome. My only fear about gliders is that they're going to disappear in the next 2 years, which would make me want to buy one right now, because once you have one, I'll tell you, if the government did something so outrageous as what you're kind of worried about, making all of these regulations retroactive, I think that would be the final straw for me. I'd get the hell out of the industry. I just don't see it happening. Let's see. Let's go. How much time do I have? Let's go to Illinois. Michael, welcome to the program.
Hey, I'm from the prior show. We were talking about technician training.
Yeah, and I ran out of time there at the end of the show, so I'll kind of jump back in. I don't see the training. I talked about money being part of the problem, and it is. Training is expensive. Our technology is moving faster than we can train people or afford to train people. But I see the bigger problem not being in whether or not there's training available. I think there's a lot available if you go look for it. You've found it. I think back to the end. I think it comes back to the individual not caring enough. And, you know,
yeah.
I can go way, way back in my career. One of the first things I did, I started painting cars when I was like 16 years old. And I managed a body shop and worked in a body shop for a short period of time. And I would pay to go to the OEMs, the car makers did training on paint technologies and all of those things. I would pay, I would take my time to go to those, and I would be the only one in there in a class of 30 or 40 or 100. I would be the only person there that was paying my own way and actually wanted to be there. Everybody else was sent because their employer made them go. It was being paid for. They were on the clock when they were there. And yet all they did was bitch about everything and want to get out early. I was the one saying, what do you mean you're going to let us go early? I paid to be here. You know, let's stay longer because I want to learn something. So look at our CMC program. It is the only business training for owner operators on the planet. This is it. There is no other program like this. There are a million owner-operators in the country, and I'm excited because we have 325 people coming, and it's our 11th year of doing it.
Yeah, no, that's great. I'm the same way. A lot of the time, I try to pay for it myself out of my own pocket, and in fact, this previous event I went to, I paid my own way because I'm like you. I want to learn. I want to make myself better. I want to be a good technician because I love my job.
But that's
rare.
Yeah,
like you said, yeah, yes it is. I would like to see more. I know there's plenty of training available, but
it just seems to me, from what I've seen, it's more like you said, you go to the OEM to do it, and that's fine. OEM training is great, but a lot of people don't realize a lot of the independent events that you can go to, especially in the automotive side. You would be blown away, Kevin, by
I'll bet.
These trainers and technicians and what they know and the different things they come up with to make you better at your job. It's just unbelievable because the OEM is obviously the best source that you can get your hands on for fixing vehicles. However, it's not always the most efficient path to fix a vehicle because I don't know about you, but if you've ever looked at a troubleshooting chart, do you ever notice on a troubleshooting chart you have about 40, 50 steps? And you look at all those steps, you're like, you're like, wait a minute. I know for a fact that I could just cut this in half. So what do you think that tech's going to do?
See,
he's not going to go 50 steps. He's going to go half of those steps. So that's the only complaint that I have.
Yeah, which requires a lot more in-depth knowledge that people, and this is where I think a lot of our technicians are going wrong. This is why we keep bringing trucks back for the same problems, because people are shortcutting the process, but they don't understand how. I'm with you. You get somebody good, they can go through all the different scenarios in their head and figure out which one has the highest likelihood of being the problem. But if you don't have that inherent knowledge, then you should follow every one of those steps. And
absolutely. I'm not arguing that. I'm just saying, I think the process of how the manufacturers develop the troubleshooting info, I think they could do a little bit better job of itemizing
absolutely.
It and making it a little bit better, you know, to understand. So that's what I'm getting at.
I agree. And again, I realize that a good technician can shortcut that process, which is good for all of us. It saves us time, saves us money. We have a higher likelihood of actually finding the problem. I just don't see a lot of people that have the talent and the knowledge and the ability to shortcut the process and find the problem. When I find those guys, I think they're worth their weight in gold.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I hear it all the time, you know, with the training, and I just don't see it available as much, and I just think, you know, it would be really nice if you could get a whole bunch of different people in the heavy-duty truck industry, transit, school bus, whatever, try to put on an event where the vendors, you know, help pay for it to make it affordable for everybody, because in my eyes, I think it would be a win-win for everybody. Not only is it a win for the technicians, but if you think about this, you've got vendors coming to these shows. Technicians are going to start asking other technicians on what's the best equipment to use. And guess what? The vendors are then going to make money on sales, which is going to help them. And it's also going to, help with networking, making more contacts.
It helps everybody. The process you're describing, I couldn't agree more. It is the model for our CMC. It's working for us, but it is damn hard, and we're in our 11th year. And, you know, OIDA tried a similar program, and I think theirs only lasted 3, maybe 4 years, and they gave up on it. It's tough to do. I think it comes back to the individual who... You know, they just don't put enough value on education. But what you see people who do, they're succeeding. So all we can do is keep hammering away. Thanks for joining me. We'll see you next time. Be safe. Be profitable. Be fit and healthy. Always do the hard work. And master the journey. Kevin Russell. All right, everybody, thanks for joining us. We'll see you tomorrow for the Power Hour and probably an hour of general questions as well. Thanks.